Hello, welcome to Nature Now for Earth Day Week. Earth Day was started 49 years ago in 1970. I remember the excitement. But now a necessary statement is, every day is Earth Day, and don't we know it? This is Mary Robson. I'm here with Alex Henley, and we are going to share some observations for you. But first, the mystery sound. I have been hearing this at night in the woods near my house. It is not a four-footed animal. That's your big clue. And it's one many of you may know. So, observations. We'll start first with a little bit of spring stuff. We have experienced weeks of growth, and now this whole world looks as if everything is growing and blooming at once. There are wild cherry trees and madrona blooming. Flowers really transform the madrone, adding this creamy color on the branch tips. And a familiar poem by A.E. Housman says, "About the woodlands I will go to see the cherries hung with snow." South Discovery Road is edged by flowering trees. So our next observation, which Alex is going to jump in on, is camas flowering at the Katai Prairie.
The blue camas flowers are in full bloom. This week they are about 6 inches up and growing very quickly. Once they were very common, and camas are now rare and are cared for here by the Olympic Peninsula Native Plant Society. For thousands of years, local tribes relied on the bulbs for nourishment. They were abundant, filling prairies. In 1806, Meriwether Lewis wrote, "At a short distance, the color resembles lakes of bright, clear water." For the Salish and many other tribes, camas bulbs were a dietary staple. People cultivated in large gardens, subdivided into family-owned plots passed down through generations. These were fertilized with seaweed, cleared of weeds and stones, and burned to control brush and grass.
Camas must be baked to be edible, in case you had been wondering. Tribal cooks used pits lined with stones for lengthy roasting. Reports say they taste somewhat like sweet potatoes when cooked. Camas keeps well when dried for the winter. It was a source of carbohydrates and also very high in protein, over 5 ounces of protein per pound of roots, and the root is a bulb, actually. In comparison, steelhead trout has 3.4 ounces of protein per pound. I suspect it is easier to consume a pound of trout than a pound of cooked camas, but it was an extremely valuable food for its nutritional value. Camas has great potential for sustainable gardening and agriculture. People plant hybrids of it for spring bloom, but it has generally lost its connection with nutrition. Luther Burbank spent years breeding hybridized camas to create bulbs the size of small potatoes. I think there was probably just no market for those. Katai Prairie is on the edge of the Port Townsend Golf Course. You enter off 19th following the sign to the cafe. Hi, today we are talking with Joost Bethun, who is the coordinator for the Jefferson County Noxious Weed Control Board. That's a lot of words, and it's a big job. Joost, we spoke last year and we said, let's get back together in the spring when people may be starting to be concerned about what's growing in their world. So here we are in a cool spring. And what I'd like to do is review with you what makes a noxious weed versus a native plant that might be less vigorous.
Thanks for having me again, Mary.
You're welcome.
So, a noxious weed is different from other vigorous plants or native vigorous plants because they have a significant impact on their environment, either economically or ecologically.
Okay.
And so noxious weeds, they get defined by the state, and they classify them in three different classifications, A, B, or C, depending on their status. And once the state classifies them, then the county weed board takes that list and tries to educate the public and eradicate the weeds.
This will consider what we're doing today as part of public education, because that's truly what it is. How do people identify the weed? I know that sometimes this is something that someone has learned, but other times someone might be looking at something and say, gosh, I don't know, what do I do about this?
Right. So if you have a plant that you cannot identify, you can bring it in to my office. Photos will sometimes help, but usually bringing it in is the best way. And if I cannot identify it, then there's also the master gardeners that actually share an office with us. And so the master gardener has identification clinics, and they can also identify noxious weeds. A good cue to know that you're looking at a noxious weed is if it's taking over, obviously, first of all. But also if there has been a disturbance, say you're doing some landscaping or construction, and suddenly one plant pops up everywhere, often a noxious weed.
So they're more likely to move into a disturbed ground situation versus something more desirable like a rhododendron.
Yeah, absolutely. Noxious weeds, they thrive on disturbance. Usually when you have a healthy ecosystem, noxious weeds will find it much harder to enter and establish themselves into that system.
If someone has got this identified, we'll talk a little bit about the person who may be on the edge of a piece of property that has them, and maybe they're climbing over into a person's landscape. Are they all required to be controlled or contained?
It'll depend on the classification of the noxious weed.
Okay, yeah. So is it the A classification that needs to be controlled?
So classification A needs to be eradicated.
Ah.
Means all plant material has to be removed. And class B noxious weeds, they have to be controlled, which means that they cannot reproduce.
So that, for instance, if it's blooming, like right now, Scott's broom is blooming, that the person would not want that to go to seed.
Exactly.
Okay, so one of the suggestions for people today is learn how to identify Scott's broom if you can't already. It's got bright yellow flowers all over it at this moment. And make sure that you do some control before it goes to seed.
Yeah, and with Scott's broom, especially when they're a little bit older and bigger, what generally is pretty effective is to just lop them off on the ground. However, if you lop off an entire plant, they will still continue to grow for a number of weeks, depending on how much water and sugars they have inside them.
Uh-huh.
So if you lop something off and you lay it down on the ground, it can still produce flowers and seeds. So
uh-huh.
You might want to
I've seen dandelions do that too, where you pull it up, lay it on the ground, and it goes to seed, just as if it hadn't been pulled. You said at one point that you also have weed wrenches that you can have people check out. Is that accurate?
Yeah, we do still have them. They have been pretty much out for the last month and a half. I haven't had any at my office in a long time, but there are several other entities that have them, including the Conservation District. So if we don't have them, you can try some other entities.
That would be particularly helpful if someone had a large patch of something that they hadn't started controlling yet. One of the things that I was wondering was, it seems as if the extremely cold weather we had has done nothing to slow any of the noxious weeds down. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I mean, basically, whenever there's conditions that aren't ideal, that goes for both the natives as well as the noxious weeds. And so I would even argue that less than ideal conditions usually favor the noxious weeds because they are so generalistic and easily adapted to a changing situation, whereas a native plant might struggle more.
Wow. At one point, I think you defined it as being a rather perfect predator, the noxious weed. It takes all the resources and lets everything starve. Another question regarding the management, say, by someone who's got a landscape that they're a little concerned about. There were pictures of some of the people working with you removing poison hemlock from Water Street last week. And I noticed that they were wearing great big gloves, almost gloves up to the elbow, to protect them from touching the plants. Is that what they're doing?
Yeah, poison hemlock is a very toxic plant. It has a neurotoxin that affects your nervous system. It kind of varies per person, but most people, when they touch it, it will feel like stinging nettle. And, obviously, if you ingest it, it is lethal. when I hire crews to do any work on those kind of plants, I make sure that they wear all the necessary protective equipment.
Does that include a face shield? I'm sorry, I couldn't tell.
No, not for poison hemlock.
Okay.
Unless you want to. Usually, you know, if they're pretty tall, then I just lop them to about a foot and a half, and then I pull that out of the ground so I don't have to deal with a 9-foot tall plant.
Let's hope that they get hauled out of there before they reach 9 feet at this point. Maybe we could also talk a little bit about the identification of poison hemlock, because that's one that does have an effect on humans. It's very distinctive, but people tend to confuse it with other things. It has a stem with parallel purple markings that almost look like spots.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering what else you might want to say about it while we're on the subject.
Yeah, so poison hemlock does have a few lookalikes. You have wild chervil, bur chervil, you know, wild carrot. For smaller kids, I've seen it be compared to fennel, which is kind of dangerous because kids sometimes like to chew fennel. So poison hemlock has, in my opinion, slightly darker brown leaves, which, you know, that's the kind of stuff that can vary, but that is something that I spot usually when I'm driving down the road. But then when you stop and you have a closer look, it's the dark purple blotched stem that...
That sounds like one of the dangers of being a noxious weed coordinator, however, is it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh, look what I saw. Well, when it has been controlled at one... say last year, I know there were some in various parts of Port Townsend last year. Once it's controlled, you also have to go back and make sure that nothing else returned, yes?
Yeah, and I mean, just to be clear, we nowhere near controlled everything. You know, we had a contract with the city to do a certain amount of work, which is great that they provided that. But I'd say we got maybe a very rough estimate, maybe like 20 to 30% that we actually removed. And, you know, there's also a seed bed. Poison hemlock has been in the city for, as far as I know, at least 25 to 30 years. And so, you know, some of these infestations have been there untouched for that amount of time. And so they create... One plant creates 10,000 seeds every year. They drop right around around that area, and they're just laying there dormantly waiting for the mm-hmm. right conditions to pop up. And so, you know, in order to get rid of noxious weeds like that, you really need a sustained effort of, considerable amount of crew time. And because Port Townsend... has made herbicide the last feasible option, which is something that I'm personally very happy about, and I agree with that option. It does make it more expensive to get rid of it because you need to have people manually pull it, which is possible for poison hemlock, and we should pull it manually.
Fairly shallow rooted, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is easy to control by hand. It just takes a lot of hours and a lot of man work,
mm-hmm.
and that is expensive.
How is it disposed of once you've pulled it up, or someone has pulled it up?
If you want to get rid... I mean, for me, in areas where, like along roadsides, I drop it on the ground, as long as they're not yet even close to flowering or anything, because no wild animal will eat that, or dogs or anything. They smell the toxins in it, and they will not touch those plants. If we have bigger infestations, we have in the past had the city Parks and Rec Department come by and pick up those piles and then take it to the solid waste facility. If you put them in the compost, the seeds will not all break down, and so don't compost it.
I think that's probably a pretty good rule for all noxious weeds, isn't it? That you would want to keep it out of a personal compost. Well, that brings us perhaps to, are there some noxious weeds that are particularly threatening to water, a stream or a small river?
Yeah, for sure. I think the two main ones in Jefferson County are reed canary grass and Japanese knotweed. Japanese knotweed is a plant that can produce roots that go up 30 to 40 feet down into the ground. They like loose gravel banks along the river. And so it makes these huge, long root networks. And the roots actually are very strong. They can destroy foundations of homes if they grow close enough. They produce a huge amount of foliage as well. And the biggest problem with Japanese knotweed is that they can regrow from even small fragments of the plant. So if you have a 1-inch cut from a root, that will regrow into a new plant. If you were to grow and mow Japanese knotweed, you're helping propagate the plant. You've created thousands of little propagules.
This is interesting because I just finished reading a description of a garden in England where it had been put in for decorative purposes. Did it come as an invader that way, that it was part of something that someone thought, oh my, this is handsome, let's put it in our garden?
Yes, I believe so. So Japanese knotweed is pretty, and I think it was part of a Victorian-style gardens back in the day. Now, I'm not entirely sure on that.
Well, this actually was a recreation of an old garden, and they were plunking in the knotweed. What's the status on control of Scots broom?
So, you know, Scots broom in the entire west side of Washington State is classified as a Class C, which means that they are not required for control. The main reason why is feasibility. If we were to classify that as required for control, we would have to legally push for the control of Scotch broom. With limited resources in public agencies, that would be a very tough sell for us to make, as well as a big ask. Well, and so we would rather have them focus on other noxious weeds.
It is a Class C weed then for purposes of practicality almost. It would be nice if it weren't here, but that's very pervasive. And I think I have heard that the seeds last for a long time.
Yeah, about 80 years. There is actually a lot of work that is being done on Scotch broom. So it's not like we're not fighting that battle. It's just that we're fighting it in places where it's feasible and where it makes sense. And so in some areas, you know, where infestation has been for hundreds of years, or other areas, for example, the airport has a thick Scotch broom infestation, it would make less sense for us to go and fight that because that area needs to be mowed continuously. And the surrounding areas are pretty infested with Scotch broom also. However, for example, the Public Utility District has been a very good neighbor on this topic, and specifically for Scotch broom, because they have their corridors that they need to maintain for their power lines. But the corridors go through some pretty pristine woodlands and forests. If we were to allow Scotch broom to infest those corridors, then it would directly threaten that pristine woodland. And so there, the control of Scotch broom is a high priority, and the PUD has been excellent in understanding that priority and working with us on preventing that from happening.
That's extremely helpful. What is your general advice to someone who has, say, 5 acres of land and just gets to wandering around on it and going, oh my goodness, look at this? The first thing, of course, would be to identify what they have. And I know that you've also got some awfully good pamphlets on noxious weeds in your office. What else would you suggest?
Yeah, so as you say, first of all, identify it. You know, figure out what you would like to do with that property. And don't expect a silver bullet. They're noxious weeds for a reason. They're that because they're very hard to get rid of. The most successful landowners that I know and that use their land well is they manage the land properly, so they don't overgraze, they don't overdisturb, and they're there often. They go out, they walk their property, they have a look around. You don't need herbicide if you're diligent on it. For some plants, herbicide is probably the only feasible way of getting rid of it, but for most plants, you know, diligent hand-pulling and being on it is honestly enough.
That's helpful.
So, yeah.
I assume that mulching the area afterward is not much help. Maybe I'm wrong.
Not for noxious weeds. I mean, it could maybe help if you put a thick layer of mulch on there, but most noxious weeds, they're not concerned about that.
I very much appreciate your being here today, and I would like people to know that your office, which is over in Port Hadlock, is accessible. You like to take questions when you can. You have lots of information. And perhaps we could suggest that people make sure that they at least have got Scots broom and poison hemlock clearly identified in their minds.
Right.
And perhaps read canary grass. Is there any other one that you would suggest as we're signing off here?
Those are probably the more common ones that they'll find. I mean, there's probably another five or ten that they will run into. But I'd say, you know, if you find something, there's a lot of it. It suddenly all came up when you bought that new bag of fertilizer or mulch or something, and now you have noxious weed. Take a few photos or come by, have a look online and see if you can't find it. Most of them are very common and should be easily taken care of.
And you are easy to find online as Noxious Weeds, correct?
Yeah, if you type in Jefferson County Noxious Weed Board, you'll find our website. Lots of info on there on fact sheets and best management practices. And those are very helpful tools.
My sense is that the most helpful thing we can all do is help people not ignore this and learn a little bit more about it. So, Yost, thank you so much for being here today. I appreciate it. I wish you small infestations, but I'm sure that's too optimistic. Anyway, thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Okay, bye. This is the mystery sound. Many of you have already figured this out. This is the barred owl. Who cooks for you? This is probably the most familiar and easily recognized owl call. The barred owl calls clearly early in the evening, although it is not strictly nocturnal. I saw one on my garage roof last year at noon. Sturdy and well adapted to this area, the owl is native to the northeastern United States, but it has moved across southern Canada to Washington State. Barred owls hunt almost anything edible, concentrating on small mammals, especially rodents, but they will snatch almost any animal that moves. They have also been known to master fishing. I would really love to see that. They nest in the spring and are permanent residents on the Olympic Peninsula, and also they are monogamous. They tend to dominate the spotted owl, which has the same territory and the same food needs. And finally, a couple of events. The first one is very interesting. If you have wondered how people know how to take care of birds that have been exposed to oil, we hope very much that you don't need to use this, but there is a training in Squim on April 27th, Saturday, from 8 to 5. And what it does, it's in the Pioneer Park Clubhouse, and it says, learn how to help oiled wildlife in advance of an oil spill. It's an interactive training. It will talk about rehabilitation. It has lots of information about wildlife handling and how to provide care for oiled birds. So for some of you, this may be something that just absolutely works. You can register or go to Clallam County's website.
You can learn about the history of Protection Island and the seabirds and marine life that make the island and surrounding waters their home on Saturday, April 27th from 1 to 4 p.m. This is aboard one of the Puget Sound Express vessels, and it starts at Point Hudson Marina. And this is sponsored by the Marine Science Center.
That's Nature Now for the week of Earth Day. We're signing off. We hope you have enjoyed this eclectic, community-based presentation on the wonderful world of nature. Nature Now repeats after the Wednesday show at noon. It repeats on Thursday afternoon at 5 p.m. It also repeats on Saturday at 12:30. You can catch it on a podcast at kptz.org. Follow the sign to podcasts and look for Nature Now. We hope your spring is going great, and happy trails.